Everyone, and welcome to minute 73 of season 7 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Aaron Newark from Out Now with Aaron and Abe. Welcome back to the show, Aaron.
Hi, hi, hi. Let's do this, guy.
Minute 73 begins with a car coming to a stop in traffic and ends with a Mercedes taking flight. So yesterday we basically ended things with Zeus proving the fact that you can start a Yugo much quicker if you don't have to try and hotwire it.
Yep.
That's more or less what he's told us.
Yeah. Just good knowledge to have.
Yeah, for sure is completely. Yeah, I need to ask like an electrician friend of mine if it really can work that easily. You know, I'm curious. You know, he'll probably answer what you said yesterday. You know, the fact that it's a Yugo, so the odds are the answer is yes.
Yeah, before there's fancy computer cars and all these things, it's like, you know, some cars are just crappy. You just shove a thing into the ignition and start it up.
That's right. Yeah, now you have to, like, you know, in certain cars, you probably need to get like a 6-digit code sent to your cell phone in order to, you know, to prove that you're not a bot in order to try and start your car. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that. So. John and Zeus are driving their Yugo, this bright yellow Yugo. You know, maybe it's Bumblebee.
It's more of like a crappy beige, but fine.
You think that's not yellow? It's not like a faded yellow?
There may have been a world where it started yellow.
But, okay. Again, if you talk about Bumblebee, he did look faded and worn out, so. It sort of makes sense.
Yeah, Bumblebee fell on some hard times.
Yes. Well, it's the 90s. We know what happened to him in the 80s. So, you know, something had to happen to him in the 90s. And apparently Zeus broke his window.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're driving and, you know, it's just really strange. They just pull over in the middle of the highway, you know, and John just gets out of the car and looks around and goes, not on the bridge. And then he goes down there, McLean, the FDR.
There's a lot of him like copping his way in this movie in a way that you haven't seen in the others, because he's actually in his element. He's in New York. And it's the kind of thing where it doesn't feel like it's the first time he's exerted his authority in order to just like get what he wants out of a situation. But even in this movie alone, he's already done things like he's on the subway, like saying, you know, I'm a cop. Look, get out of my way. Get a move, please. I got to check for the bomb and all that. Like, here is just like, I'm a cop. I get to stop on the freeway on a bridge or whatever. Yes. just immediately go out in the street and just go see what's going on here. It seems like his drive through Central Park, of course. Like, I'm a cop. I can do this. Like, it's not I can call it an ambulance for officer down and be fine. Like, it's no big deal.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually one of the things that I really like about this movie, is because in the first two movies the idea was fish out of water. Yeah. And here they're showing us, you know, how he acts as a fish in water.
Yeah.
And it's just done really well.
This is fantastic.
We know he's in his element.
Yeah. It's a fantastic New York movie for that reason. Like, regardless of the logic of geography as far as how he's getting to certain places, in terms of like placing him in his element and letting us just see New York in the way we get to see it here in this frantic action movie that's actually filmed on the streets of New York, it does a really good job of like, setting him up to be in a different sort of environment. So you're like making the sequel feel fresh because it's a big city and it's his city, while still like showing you the excitement of someone that has to like, by the skin of their teeth, get through a variety of obstacles dealing with a terrorist or, a bank robber in this case.
Right. It's true. So he says that, you know, look down there at the FDR. So, I mean, I don't know how much you know about New York or whatever, but are you familiar with what the FDR is?
I know it's the one of the many bridges.
No, it's actually, it's a highway. The Franklin D. Roosevelt East River Drive, which is commonly known as the FDR Drive. Mm-hmm. you know, it goes from south to north on the east side of Manhattan. And because of the way that it's built, and we're going to touch upon this, Connie's going to touch upon this, I think tomorrow, or maybe it's only on Friday. But basically it's built with elevated sections. And because of this, it has weight limits, and you can only have up to 8,000 pounds driving on it. So basically, commercial vehicles are completely banned from the FDR Drive, which is something that they're going to come across. Which is interesting that they actually do see these, see these dump trucks down at the bottom there, which is interesting. Like, I don't know if there's anyone, making sure that, that you're allowed to go there. I don't know how that really works.
How do you
stop a dump truck from going on the FDR Drive? That's my question.
Well, you don't necessarily stop it. Like any truck driver would know, they understand their routes and which roads they're allowed to be on or what not to begin with. And when that's not the case, they get pulled over. Now we're in a scenario where a bomb has gone off multiple times in a day in the city. Cops are busy. And that's what Simons anticipated. So he can get away with doing certain things like, yeah, we're not going to go over some dump trucks for some minor fines right now. We have terrorists bombing our city. We can't just deal with this is low priority.
Right. Okay. Do you know when they started building this FDR Drive?
No idea.
They actually started calling it the East River Drive at the beginning, and they started construction of it in the 1930s. And little by little, they kept adding more and more sections to it over the years. And, after FDR died, they decided, hey, I think we're going to change the name. So they named it after FDR, who was governor of New York. So it sort of makes sense that they would do that. And one of the things they mentioned here is that there are three like half bridges, like underpasses that you have to go through here, which it's really interesting because in this movie that comes up also. You know, we get to see the repercussions of that, I guess you can say. So at this point, then, Zeus also gets out of the car, which is like really funny. You know, you have these two people standing on the side of in the middle of the lane. Then they both just get out of the car and they look over at the Brooklyn Bridge and don't see anything. And then, because they see them on the FDR, then OK. And did you count how many dump trucks we see on the FDR?
Like four or something? Yeah.
Five. There's five.
That was close. All right.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah. And you can see that they're on like an elevated bridge or an elevated section, I guess, of the thing. And then they get back in the car and Zeus starts driving off, and it's, to me, it's strange that nobody's honking at them and screaming at them because they're not supposed to know that it's a cop. Any movie you see dealing with New York and traffic and stuff like that, someone's going to get out and start, screaming and yelling and cursing. What the hell are you doing over there? Whatever you can think about that. Yeah. And so they start driving and it's just really, really funny. John wants to take the phone out of his pocket and he pulls out like a broken phone. And he goes, and John goes, oh, what? They shot the phone. Too bad.
I know. The delivery of that's perfect. He's like, shit, what? Shot the phone. And Zeus is like, you bad. Like, the whole arc of Zeus and John becoming like more familiar and friendlier with each other. It's like, it's so emblematic in these kinds of moments where their banter feels incredibly natural. And
yes,
that's completely. So much of what I love about like this kind of like middle section where they have their differences, but they're so in the moment. But and they're again, that chemistry between Jackson and Willis is so strong where it feels so like it flows in exactly the right kind of way. And this sequence in particular, I wrote down banter as my notes, because like, yeah, the banter is such like at a good pace right now.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, they do such a great job throughout this entire movie with that. So, you know, I definitely love the way that they continue it throughout. That's what it basically comes down to. You know, and as we know, these are two great actors who are able to do that. You know, it's just unbelievable.
It's a big part. Like when I was growing up, I watched this movie. I saw it first of the Die Hard movies. So for the longest time, this was my favorite Die Hard movie. And I still give these both this and the first one the same grade. Like I think this movie is pretty spectacular. It's one of my favorite action movies of the 90s, if not ever, because it's just McTiernan's just doing his thing. But it is specifically because I think the Willis Jackson chemistry is so good in this movie. Like that's one thing that Die Hard doesn't have, because Willis is more or less on his own in that movie. This movie, it's like if you're going to change things up a bit, okay, this one's a buddy movie essentially, like that happens to have high stakes and, you know, the regular stuff of Die Hard. And like, so yeah, like just these two together, just fantastic.
Well, did you know that the script was originally written as a standalone, it had nothing to do with Die Hard, and then the first thing they wanted to do with it was use it as a Lethal Weapon movie.
I know that, and I do like the running theme of Die Hard sequels becoming a Die Hard sequel after the fact.
Yes, well, I mean, it sort of makes sense, I guess, you know.
Well, yeah, it's like, because you just, you know, like apply a label to this and we'll get it made. Like, I get the logic of how that works. It's just funny that that's every Die Hard sequel. Like, we'll just take some other script and slap Die Hard on it and make it work.
I mean, there is logic to that.
Of course there is. It's just funny that there's no, like, not one of these is originally a Die Hard movie. It's just like, now it's a Die Hard movie.
Right. Well, the first one wasn't either. From that perspective.
Yeah, it's the sequel to The Detective.
That's right. Correct, which makes sense. You know, I don't know. So then for me, it's just very strange. John only notices now that he's got a broken phone in his pocket.
I mean, you know, keep track of all the stuff in your pockets? You? Sure. What? He has a lot going on. What's he going to think? Oh, I got to let me think about my cell phone. Like,
No, but this... As you've seen, the cell phones then are not like the cell phones today. Okay, today if you have a broken cell phone, it's not going to have that many wires. You know what he pulls out of his shirt there. You know that's the thing.
If I want to like dive into it, which is that what's what we're doing, it could have like when it was in his pocket, it could have still been feeling like one piece, and by the time he pulls it out of his pocket, it separates from the rest of the phone, so he just has what's left.
Okay. All right, there is something to that.
It doesn't feel like it's in half in his pocket until he actually pulls out, and it's like, oh, the other piece fell off. It's still in the rest of my pocket. Like, all right, like my phone.
Right. Okay. That does make sense.
They're big phones. I agree. I hear you. it's a big device. Right. I get that.
Again, I don't know how old you were when this movie came out, but. You know, I remember those big phones.
It's 95, so I would have been 9.
Okay. All right. I was 21, so I do remember the first bits of cell phones when people started, you know, using them for more than just having them as car phones. Like in the 80s, there were people who had them as car phones. I remember, like, you know, there was a guy in my neighborhood everyone said, wow, he's got a car phone. You know, it was like a big deal back then. And it was a humongous car phone. You know, it wasn't like what we have nowadays and stuff like that. You know, obviously things have gotten a little bit smaller over the last few decades. But yeah, these were bulky. the batteries themselves were nice and bulky. And then we get back to the riddle, because the two of them are just looking at each other and trying to figure out, okay, where do we go from here? And you know, at this point, John goes, come on, what's 21 out of 42? And he goes, I don't have a clue.
21 again. And then half of 20 is half of 42.
Right. Well, that they've already said. And then Zeus goes, well, what about Yankee Stadium? And he goes, well, we'll get there. But that son of a bitch is not getting off of Manhattan, meaning we got to stop them before these dump trucks get out of here. And then a car just about cuts them off. And we hear, move, Jesus Christ. And then he goes, who do you think you are, lady? Hillary Clinton.
That's it.
He goes, that's it. Hillary Clinton. What? The 42nd president. No, she'd be the 43rd president. All right. But who's the 21st? I don't know.
I like the logic of, like, it can't just be read as, yeah, Clinton, 42nd president. It's, I'm specifically picturing Hillary Clinton as the 43rd president, therefore your math is wrong. Like, he, like, stops the point that's right out to him is very funny to me.
Exactly. Now, I find it hilarious that, you know, this movie, which came out in 1995, references both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Again, I'm not going into politics here at all or anything like that. I just find it hilarious that this movie happens to reference both of them, you know, within just within a few minutes of each other, basically. Yeah. And, you know,
I mean, they are for better or worse, New York icons. Like, I get where it comes from.
Well, no, one second. In 1995, sure. Hillary Clinton was not a New York icon.
Okay.
You know, she was, you know, at this point, she's the first lady. This is before she became a senator. She didn't become a senator until, was it 2001? So, you know, so she's, you know, now she's a New York icon. But back then, she wasn't. But it was just, you know, obviously McClane is using that because of the fact that everyone was talking at the time that she was the one basically running the country.
I mean, I'd argue that becoming the first lady makes you into an icon. But I hear your logic.
You said a New York icon, a New York icon. That's what I was saying. She might have been a Washington icon. She wasn't a New York icon. You know, that's the differentiation I you know, wanted to make about that.
Got it.
So I just find it really funny that you know that just throw that out in here. You know, it's like, hey, all right, well, why don't we just talk about, you know, we'll call this lady Hillary Clinton. You know, she's someone who's just taking over the road and doing whatever she wants. And then their banter continues. And he goes, you don't know? He goes, no, I don't know. Do you know? No. Well. And then they realize that the car's not moving very well. And they go, what kind of engine does this piece have? Come on, step on it. And then Zeus turns to John and goes, it's a Yugo. It's built for economy, not speed. Mm-hmm. And John just has enough of it. He grabs the wheel and turns it to the side because he sees a guy driving with, you know, driving in a Mercedes with or talking on his cell phone, and he goes, and he just spins the car to the other side and just goes, well, what are you doing? He goes, I'm going to get us another phone. Which, again, it's a great move, especially at this time, because, you know, in 1995, as we just mentioned, most people did not have cell phones. So to, you know, if you see someone driving in a car with a cell phone, okay, I can understand why you would say, all right, this is where I'm going to go get a cell phone to be able. Again, there's little logic here about how John is supposed to try and get in touch with Cobb, because Cobb gave John his cell phone. So if I gave you my cell phone and you wanted to call me after that, and you have my cell phone, so how do you call me? And that's in 2024. So how does that work in 1995, where most people don't have cell phones?
Yeah, I, you know, the pre-phone world. It's certainly fun to think about.
Okay, but we all in some way, shape, or form lived through it, you know, and
obviously,
and that's, you know,
centuries were lived through it.
Yes,
as far as exactly. Being a modern type era without having instant communication with each other. Yes,
that's correct. And no, but the idea was is that you know, when Cobb gave John his phone, he says, if you need to get in touch with me, go through the switchboard. But again, how's the switchboard supposed to find it? You know, and again, this continues.
A lead cop on a scene. I'm sure there's like a way to connect to some degree.
He's got to get another cell phone, I guess. I don't know.
He'd have to, but I mean, but in terms of like, he's going to be around a lot of people. They're using a switchboard. It's like there's a, you know, without seeing the, I don't know, the timeline of people it took to get to Cobb to begin with, I imagine there's still a way to get to him to some degree.
Right. Yeah, but I mean, again, we never 100% find out about that, the way that they did it. But, you know, and what I love is that, you know, again, we get that cut, you know, as you talked about it earlier, where there's just like a quick jump cut. And, you know, we see them basically cut off the Mercedes, and then the next shot, you know, we see them driving away with the Mercedes, you know, or I mean, that car is just burning rubber. You know, he really is getting ready to travel through time with the way that he's going that fast. And we see we can see the guy in the car, you know, with his hand out when he gets cut off. We see his like hand outside of the window holding onto his phone, you know, for dear life, I guess you could say. And that's how this minute ends. So is there anything else you want to say about this minute?
No, I think we covered it.
Okay. All right. So the script, it continues along with this whole thing when they're in the Yugo, and it says they actually have a different scene here. It's a scene at like one of the schools. It says Bomb Squad Chief Charlie Weiss stands outside a public school in the Bronx. The entire block is barricaded off. A subordinate is briefing him. They're halfway down in Brooklyn. We're still behind schedule in Westchester County. Weiss looks up at two Bomb Squad members come down the steps of the school, shaking their heads at Weiss. Weiss turns to his people. Franklin Elementary on Cortland Park Avenue. Let's move it, people. Weiss and his men mobilize for the next school, and we cut back to the entrance ramp of the Brooklyn Bridge. The Yugo struggles up the ramp to the Brooklyn Bridge and stops. Zeus and McLean get out. Cars whiz past, honking. Zeus and McLean look around. From this vantage, they can see to the east the Brooklyn Bridge, to the west Lower Manhattan, Wall Street, and the Bowery, and to the north the FDR Expressway stretching up the East River. Zeus and McLean's point of view scanning the Brooklyn Bridge. There are no dump trucks on the bridge. Nothing on the bridge. McLean. Zeus is pointing towards Zeus and McLean's point of view north of the FDR. Lumbering up the FDR, about a mile north, is a line of 10 industrial dump trucks. McLean and Zeus get in the Yugo and roar down the ramp onto the FDR. On 59th and Broadway at Columbus Circle, several police vans are parked in the Rotary Island at Columbus Circle, a makeshift NYPD command center. Chief Cobb sits in the open van, chewing gum. Lambert and Walsh are reporting to him. They're almost finished with the Bronx. We're worried about Brooklyn, but the airport and Triborough cops covered our ass. Walsh then says, the kids have been put in common areas, gymnasiums and cafeterias. Charlie's guys are going school to school. So far, they haven't found any word from McLean. Nothing. Don't worry. He'll call. The Hugo travels with McLean and Zeus. McLean is pounding his fist to the dash. Where's a goddamn phone? Car phones don't exactly come standard in pieces of like this. You want me to pull over and lose the trucks? That. Up ahead through the windshield, the dump trucks move slowly to the right lane, about three-fourths of a mile ahead. Zeus looks at his watch. It's 1:45. We had an hour and 15. What about the library? We've got to get that disarming code. So just to point out to you and anyone who forgot the script, they don't have to go to Yankee Stadium. They have to go to the New York Public Library to get their next hoop, go through the next hoop. So then McLean says, what good will it do? We don't know where the bomb is. What's 27 out of 40? Don't look at me. Wait a minute. Clinton's the 42nd president. They stare at each other. It's dawning on them. President, that's it. That's got to be it. You're a genius. So who was the 27th? I don't know. You don't know, do you? No, I got a D in history. This thing's a go-kart. Where the phone? McLean. Zeus is pointing out the side window at a Mercedes, moving in traffic right next to them. At the wheel is a yuppie stockbroker engrossed in conversation on a cellular phone. McLean and Zeus exchange a knowing glance. And then we cut to the Mercedes tire squealing away from the FDR Expressway breakdown lane. So again, I think it's done much better in the movie. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff that's just not needed in the script. So they cut it out. They cut out the right things. I guess you can look at it from that perspective. So I liked what they did there. Every Wednesday, we have a segment called Jesus Hump Day, where my guests will give their top five Samuel L. Jackson performances. So once again, Aaron, will you start with your number five and work your way up?
Oh, boy. Now, this was fun to narrow down because there's a lot of stuff to get into. as far as like where he's shining the best as a performer, because I think Sam Jackson is such a such a great screen presence that you know it could be tough to be like distinguishing like what's just like him doing great as a performer versus him just like being magnetic on the screen. Sometimes it's one of them, but right. In terms of what I have here, what I try to give myself parameters for these things. And so I specifically only chose two. I limited myself to two Tarantino performances because I didn't want to just overrun the list in that way, which meant I had to leave off Pulp Fiction, which was wild to me. But I'm like, yeah, I like in terms of like what we're seeing from him. So going five up, I have Unbreakable, it's Mr. Glass. Then I have Django Unchained, where I think his work as Steven is chilling, like for a variety of reasons. But I think it's pretty, seeing him do something new in the world of Tarantino, I thought was very impressive. Black Snake Moan, which is an absolutely fantastic performance that I would assume would be more underrated than others would think. But it's just a really good performance in a movie that has a lot of wild swings that it takes, and he's great in it. Jackie Brown as Ordell Roby this was almost my number one, and it used to be for the longest time, but I think Ordell Roby, that's my favorite Sam Jackson Tarantino performance. I think he's so good in this, where he's taking what we already know about him and Tarantino and dialing it in a slightly different direction to make a villain character who's so composed in a certain way, but still has that delivery that you get from Jules in Pulp Fiction. I think his performance as Ordell is just wonderful. And then number one is Spike Lee's Jungle Fever, where this is him, I think, at his absolute best as a performer. I think he's taking real life struggles that he's had as a former drug addict and applying them to this character in a way that's so authentic and so believable and so affecting that, what used to be what I think my claim for best Jackson, Jackie Brown, was overshadowed, because I think he's so good. I didn't catch Jungle Fever until a little later. And so when I eventually finally saw it, it's like this is just absolutely the best Sam Jackson. I think he's just so good in this movie in a way that easily could have got him more recognition if he was more well known at the time. But he's really great there. I will shout out, because I didn't want to count not movies, but there's an Apple series called The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray that came out a couple years ago. He is great in that. It's a really good series. He's very good in it, playing very introspective and playing into the fact that he's older and has things to contend with about his life. It's a really good show, and I think he's absolutely fantastic in it. So I just wanted to shout that one out as well.
All right, very cool. I've actually never heard of that. I'll have to check that out. Sounds very interesting. Is it? It's a show.
It was an Apple streaming series. Yeah, it was. It's like, I don't know, 6 or 8 episodes or something like that. It came out a few years ago. But it's online. So
all right, I'll have to check that out. All right, so Aaron, would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, I am available on you can hear me on the podcast Out Now with Aaron and Abe. My friend Abe and I discuss weekly new movie releases. I am the editor in chief at We Live Entertainment. All my movie reviews can be found over there. I write Criterion and Blu-ray reviews at whysoblue.com. Everything I do can be found on my personal Substack page, the code is zeke.substack.com, and I'm on all the socials at Aaron's PS4.
And while you're doing that, you can review and subscribe to any podcast you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Instagram, you can find me on Twitter. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movieroundminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker!
He comes marching home again, hoorah, hoorah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then, hoorah, hoorah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies, they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.